From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A UPS worker wins an $80 million sex harassment judgment against UPS. What is sexual harassment anyway? Will a backlash against the media frenzy over the Clinton scandal undermine 20 years of sexual harassment law? Also, the CIA says Russia sold Iraq biological weapons. What about sales by the United States and Britain? Finally, who is Richard Scaife and what did he pay for? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq denied a report that it had sought to buy equipment from Russia to make biological weapons, but said there had been contacts with Russian firms to supply a fermentation reservoir for an animal feed factory. An Iraqi government spokesperson denounced yesterday's report by the Washington Post that UN inspectors had found evidence of a Russian deal to sell Iraq equipment, including a 5,000-liter fermentation vessel that could be used to develop biological weapons. Government spokesperson said the U.S. administration aims by leaking this report to the Washington Post to thwart the intense efforts Russia is making to achieve a diplomatic solution to the current problem between Iraq on one side and the U.N. Special Commission and the United States on the other. The spokesperson quoted by the Iraqi news agency yesterday said the leaking of this false information amounted to media and diplomatic terrorism against Russia. Russia yesterday dismissed the Washington Post story as crude inventions. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Yevgeny Primakov said today the search for a diplomatic solution to the Iraq crisis should not end before UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has visited Baghdad. Primakov also said he'd spoken to U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright by telephone overnight, but gave no details. Yesterday, he spoke to the foreign ministers of Iran, Sweden, and Japan. His ministry said in a statement that those three ministers had all agreed with Primakov that diplomatic efforts should be coordinated by Annan. William Cohen, who is winding up a three-day stay in the Russian capital, said, "We agree there should be a diplomatic resolution of this if possible, but there must be compliance. Less than full compliance by Iraq would not be satisfactory." The Associated Press reports Iraq reportedly has developed a new missile. A London-based Arab newspaper says the range of the missile won't enable it to reach Israel, but it could reach Kuwait. Meanwhile, the U.S. continues its buildup in the Persian Gulf with more warplanes heading over today. On the domestic front, Monica Lewinsky is back in Washington this morning. She was described as eager to be near her mother, who required medical attention after undergoing more than 7 hours of questioning before a grand jury Tuesday and Wednesday. Prosecutors are particularly interested in Marsha Lewis's testimony because Lewinsky reportedly confided to her mother about her relationship with President Clinton. The president has denied the relationship was sexual. Meanwhile, prosecutors summoned a retired Secret Service officer and subpoenaed an active duty uniformed officer at the White House to determine whether they can shed light on Lewinsky's relationship with President Clinton. And as all this goes on, a number of prosecutors are questioning the tactics of Kenneth Starr. The key witness against Sergeant Major Jean McKinney ended her testimony by telling jurors the Army's former top enlisted man made crude come-ons and denying she fabricated evidence against him. McKinney was removed as Sergeant Major of the Army after six women accused him of sexual misconduct last year. He could get 55 and a half years in prison if convicted. His lawyers claim the women are lying and that McKinney has been unfairly targeted because he's black. Earlier this week, Staff Sergeant Christina Fetro said she taped a conversation with McKinney in which he appears to coach her on what she should tell investigators. Fetro was the prosecution's first witness. Cuba says it's releasing 200 prisoners, including some political dissidents, in response to an appeal by Pope John Paul II during his visit to the island. Havana said 106 prisoners on the Pope's list had already been freed, and dozens of others are now in the process of being pardoned. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat threatened to cross out peace agreements with Israel and launch a new Palestinian uprising if negotiations with Israel remain stalled. The two made little progress in Washington talks this week. Palestinian police and Israeli troops aimed guns at each other in a Gaza confrontation. A Southern Colombia mayor says right-wing gunmen flown in by military helicopters have killed 48 suspected rebel sympathizers in and near the city of Puerto Asís in recent days. The army disputes the accusations, which have created a stir in Bogota. Sudan's first vice president died with at least eight others in a plane crash 435 miles south of Khartoum. The government says the plane overshot a runway, but Christian and animist rebels who have fought a 15-year-old insurgency claimed they shot it down. And House Republicans tried to push through a bill to allow certain states to remove people from the voter rolls if they're unable to prove their United States citizenship. The bill, strongly opposed by Democrats, did not pass. And finally, in Indonesia, the General Suharto told the military to take action against his opponents as tensions rose in Indonesia before his expected confirmation for a new term in office next month. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And I should say about that bill that the Congress did not pass on citizenship, it did get a majority of the votes, but they were trying to get it through with a suspension of the rules and thus needed two-thirds of the vote. But it would have required the INS and the Justice Department and Social Security to verify anybody who was challenged out of voting for the right to vote. They'd have to be verified. So it would have created a real problem with, especially with Latino voters throughout the country.
Well, Juan, it looks like we are right now joined by Kathy Kelly in Baghdad, Iraq. She joins us on the telephone right now. People may remember that Kathy Kelly is with Voices in the Wilderness, the Chicago group that has been challenging the embargo against Iraq for many years. And she has just gotten through from Baghdad. She and a group of others went to Baghdad over the last few days, a very brave group, considering the U.S. could bomb Iraq at any time. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kathy.
Hello, Amy. Thank you.
Can you tell us what is happening in Baghdad right now?
Well, today is the day when many thousands of people all across Baghdad are very conscious that it's the seventh year since two astonishingly smart bombs penetrated the ventilation system of a shelter called the Amaria Shelter. And when those two bombs exploded, all of the people huddled inside. There were at least 500 civilians who were there because they had sought a safe night's sleep. All of those people were melted. And so I just came from that site, and I was with people who were survivors or who had lost their loved ones. And to hear the people speak about how much love and longing they have for all of those people that were lost is, of course, very moving. But also, some people said to them, well, do you think this could ever happen again? And every person that we spoke with said, yes, we can believe anything now because thousands of our children are dying all the time. Every day they're losing their loved ones, the children, to sanctions. And so we are very much conscious that with all of that sense of mourning and bereavement, the people we're speaking to are also very, very frightened of what could happen in the very near future. There was a little four-year-old girl we talked to today, and she said, will I die? Will my sister die? And people have been saying, we have dealt with warfare for so long, we wonder when it will ever end. And some are saying we're going to try to have a good meal because we think we're going to perhaps be moving toward our last meals.
And in terms of the preparations for by the people in Baghdad for a possible American attack, what is your sense in terms of the general population since you've been there?
Well, I think people feel pretty defenseless. I know that some people have left Baghdad who had places that they could go to where they felt they might be safer. But in a way, we sort of hear a kind of nervous laughter, and some say, well, is your country going to pound us again? I think that this time is particularly psychologically wearing on people because they have no idea what might be coming, but they certainly have the memories of when they were bombarded and pounded so badly 7 years ago.
Kathy Kelly, is there any anger at Saddam Hussein for not opening the weapons sites to international inspectors?
Now, I have to say, this is really my first day having arrived in Baghdad, but honestly, what I've heard from several people is that they would do the same thing if they were him.
Because?
Well, again, this is my first day here. I think that perhaps people feel as though They are quite vulnerable right now to, obviously, to the United States and the United Nations' intent to possibly bombard them. And yet, given that, I think they know that they're also very vulnerable right now to invasions from neighboring states. And I suppose perhaps there is a feeling that the sovereignty, the pride of Iraq needs to be maintained.
I have to say, it sounds like we're listening to all of the sounds between us here in New York and you in Baghdad. It's quite amazing to make this connection. But for listeners who didn't hear you speak on Democracy Now! Just a few days ago, just before you left for Baghdad, can you explain why you are there and how many other people did you go to Iraq with?
Amy, I'm here with a delegation of 8 people. We're 2 from the United Kingdom and 6 from the United States, from different cities across the United States. We've come here to, again, violate the United States sanctions against Iraq, which we believe to be, we know that the greatest evidence of a weapon of mass destruction in Iraq today is to be found in the pediatrics wards of every hospital where children are suffering the terrible consequences of this 7-year state of siege. So we've bought medicines. We have $110,000 worth of medicine to deliver. It's just a drop in the bucket compared to the need. But we're also here now wanting to be...
Well, there goes Kathy. Well, it's still amazing to get to speak to her in Baghdad, and I want to thank her very much for calling us from the Iraqi capital. And we do hope to speak with her over the next week or two in Baghdad. Her group, Voices in the Wilderness, is expected to be there for 2 weeks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. As we move on to a domestic issue, a former UPS manager who says the company retaliated after she complained that she was sexually harassed has been awarded nearly $81 million. An Iowa jury agreed with Linda Channon that the shipping company fostered a hostile work environment. Channon said she was poked in the breast by a driver she supervised. He was fired but later rehired. After the 22-year employee complained that he was stalking her, she said UPS shunned and excluded her from meetings and gave her assignments that men weren't given. The company says it will appeal the verdict. Well, we're going to talk about this case and also the issue of what is sexual harassment anyway, and the question of whether a backlash against the media frenzy over the Clinton sex scandal will undermine 20 years of sexual harassment law. We're joined right now by Roxanne Conlon, an attorney who just won that sexual harassment case in Des Moines, Iowa, and Louise Fitzgerald, one of the leading academics on the issue of sexual harassment. Louise Fitzgerald, a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Roxanne Conlon? Congratulations on your victory. Can you explain more what it is that your client suffered while she worked for UPS?
Virtually every kind of sex discrimination and sexual harassment that exists was a part of her life at UPS over the 22-year span of her employment. Unwanted touching, language, jokes, supervisors trying to kiss her when she was a subordinate employee until the end when, after she complained about the conduct of the driver, she was subjected to a very concerted effort to just simply get her out of the workplace. And that was done by constant belittling comments, demeaning, and just generally thoroughly hostile work environment. And she was held to standards that men were not held to. Ultimately, they determined that a way to get rid of her was to criticize her performance. And in fact, we were able to show the jury clearly that her performance in virtually every job she ever held was superior to the men who held it before her and the men who held it after her.
And at trial, how long did the trial last?
Can you hear us?
Yes.
Roxanne Conlon,
yes.
How long did the trial last?
It lasted 5 weeks.
And in terms of, could you tell us a little bit in terms of the defense that was put forth by the company?
One of the defenses was, in fact, that she had performance problems, but that was, from their own documents, easy to rebut. Another defense was they did all they needed to do, which was to ultimately fire the guy, But when they brought him back, they took no steps whatsoever to protect her from him, and he stalked her in the workplace. He followed her, he stared at her, he came to her with grievances and was just there every single day.
Can you tell us, Louise Fitzgerald, I know that you were an expert witness in this case, Louise Fitzgerald, professor of psychology at the University of Urbana-Champaign, how this case fits in general into the sexual harassment cases that have been brought over the last 20 years?
Well, I think that this is actually it's a much more typical case than people seem to realize. Most people, when they think about sexual harassment, they think about sex, as in, I want somebody to go to bed with me. That is what all the discussion is about. That is what all the criticism is about in terms of, oh, goodness, this is so ambiguous. You know, some people might be flattered. Some people might be offended. We really can't turn this into literally a federal case. But in fact, the great majority of sexual harassment is not sexual in that sense. Rather, it is hostile, as it was in the case of Linda Channon. These are very common situations in which a woman goes into what has been a male workplace, and the men want to either get her out of there or they react to her as a woman in this environment rather than as a worker, and they start sexualizing her, making egregious comments about her, making approaches to her. But it's not, I mean, we're not talking about somebody trying to establish a relationship here. We're talking about someone doing physical, psychological, assaultive damage to someone. And I think it's very typical. Most of the cases I testify in are of this type.
And as I understand it, in some of your research and writings, you've made a distinction between the legal concept of sexual harassment and this psychological experience that you're talking about of victimization. Could you clarify for us what the differences are in terms of what the law recognizes as what you can seek legal remedy from?
Well, that's probably Roxanne's question more than mine, but what I can say is that I think where we make a very big error is in equating sexual harassment, the experience, with sexual harassment, the legal cause of action. Hostile work environments existed long before Title VII. And presumably they would continue to exist even if Congress were to reverse that legislation. Nobody knows whether anything is legally sexual harassment until the jury comes back. If Linda Channon's jury had decided that for whatever reason, either she didn't complain soon enough or that the company had done what they needed to do, or that she wasn't injured, or for whatever reason they did not find in her favor, then legally she would not have been sexually harassed. But in terms of her experience, it would still have occurred. Whenever these things come out, people start saying, as they did with the Anita Hill situation, oh, well, that's not sexual harassment. After all, she didn't complain. Or it wasn't that serious, or she didn't suffer any, you know, like they didn't fire her. But that doesn't mean that there was not an experience that occurred that was offensive, that may have been frightening, and that typically has very serious psychological consequences, even if the behavior would not meet any legal criterion.
We're talking to Louise Fitzgerald, professor of psychology and women's studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and Roxanne Conlon, an attorney who just won a major sexual harassment case yesterday in Des Moines, Iowa, against UPS, an $80 million judgment. When we come back, we'll also be joined by a Republican congressmember from Louisville, Kentucky, Ann Northup. But I do want to point out that the reason that we're talking about this today is, in terms of the Clinton sex scandal, we know very little We cannot determine the facts based on what we have been told so far. But the reason we are looking at this is it seems that the whole discussion of sexual harassment has been in some way, a lot of misinformation has been put out about sexual harassment around the Clinton sex scandal. And we wanted to clarify what the body of law is that has been built up over the last 20 years, at the beginning with Professor Catherine MacKinnon, and talk about women who have experienced sexual harassment. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about what is sexual harassment anyway, with the backlash against the media frenzy over the Clinton scandal, will this undermine 20 years of sexual harassment law? Our guests, Louise Fitzgerald, professor of psychology, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, Roxanne Conlon, an attorney who deals with sexual harassment cases and just won a major case yesterday in Des Moines, Iowa, against UPS, an $80 million judgment. And we're joined now by Republican Congressmember Ann Northup. She's a first-term freshman congressmember from Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Northup. What about your take? You know, it is very hard, I think, for people around the country to figure out what's going on in Washington right now. On the one hand, when there are charges of sexual harassment, people have to take them very seriously. But what we're hearing in Washington right now, we can't determine anything from them.
Well, I think that's right. There are lots of aspects to this case. There's the legal aspects, and that really might be better formed out of the spotlight. It certainly kind of star the department, the cabinet, the Justice Cabinet. They're responsible for that. There's certainly personal, moral, and ethical questions that people get. It will answer individually, but I think that the question of how women are treated in the workplace is something we have worked very hard on in this country over the last 10 years. And I think that change is always hard, behavioral change is always hard, but it's been important, and it's been good for this country, it's been good for women. And I would hate to see us back away from defining sort of some basic important aspects about how women are treated in the workplace. I think particularly, you know, women across this country, I'm 50 years old now, so, you know, I'm not right out of school and I'm not young, but I think many young women come out of school and go into the workplace and they want to be judged on how good a job they do and how hard they work. And they don't want to have a different criteria for women. They hate to arrive at the workplace and find out that maybe for women there are a few different standards, that maybe they're supposed to be a little more charming, a little more flirtatious, that and both seeing other women that get ahead that way and seeing others left behind because they don't exhibit those qualities are very demeaning and undercut their confidence that a job well done is what matters.
Congressmember, We've been looking at the Wall Street Journal today, and there's a front page column, Washington Wire, special weekly report from the Wall Street Journal's Capitol Bureau, and it says Republicans prepare for potential impeachment efforts with trepidation. Gingrich is preparing for a hypothetical, an aide says, with his call to beef up the Judiciary Committee staff in case Kenneth Starr triggers House proceedings. And a GOP consultant, Gene Olmes, says the disaster scenario for the Republicans is to take this thing up when it doesn't pass legal muster. What's your sense of where this stands in Congress right now, the possibility of impeachment hearings, this taking this away from the general issue of sexual harassment to the possibility that Starr would hand this over?
Well, I think that that report is highly overblown. I have been with the Republican conference over the last couple of days. We are absolutely committed to carrying on the responsibilities that are before us, including the appropriations process, the budget, reauthorization of certain programs, and meeting emerging needs. And there is almost a steadfast commitment to understanding that while we might need to be prepared, that that is not what we are about today, that there is not the evidence to support us beginning any sort of a process like that, and nor is there any indication that this country does not have a leader that can continue. And in fact, I think we all feel that to get involved in an impeachment proceeding will distract from the correct process of going forward. So I really think it's a very overblown report.
Well, I'd like to ask Louise Fitzgerald, who's on the line with us here also. In the Monica Lewinsky situation obviously arose in the process of the continuing suit around the Paula Jones case. To what degree do you think that the kind of attention that has been focused on these issues over the last several months is going to have an impact on other women across the country who are subjected to, who continue to be subjected to sexual harassment in terms of their feelings as to whether they can come forward or file lawsuits, and what the whole notoriety that has developed around this, how that's going to have an impact on the willingness of women to come forward?
Well, obviously, I can only speculate, but I do have two thoughts about that. And one is, in the first place, I'm not quite sure what the Monica Lewinsky matter has to do with sexual harassment. I have so far not heard anyone say that this young woman has claimed that she was forced to do anything or required to do anything, or that anything happened that she did not want to have happen.
You know, I am just so amazed at your approach. I mean, I think the question is, what about the other 25 women that were interns in that White House and hoped that they would have a job opportunity for a paid job?
Republican Congressmember Northup.
Oh, I certainly agree with you. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that if this occurred, it was not unethical, that it was, I mean, most major companies would fire, and in fact some have recently, a chief executive who had a relationship with a subordinate, whether it was, even if it was consensual. I'm simply saying that in terms of the way we usually think about sexual harassment, which is that legally it has to be unwanted. I mean, that's the only basis for it. If we don't insist on that, that is what contributes to this, I think, backlash, where people are saying, oh, my Lord, if I even look at this woman, it's going to be sexual harassment, even if she wants me to look at her. And this has a terrible backlash against women, because then the men don't want to have anything to do with them.
Congressmember Northup.
Well, I think the conversation that began this discussion earlier last week is not whether or not this is technically or legally sexual harassment. I think it's sort of, why did we have such a strong call for a public and full airing of questions in the, say, Thomas Supreme Court hearings when they, and part of the reason, of course, was to raise this sort of awareness in the workplace of what happens when, I mean, what happens is not what happened to Monica Lewinsky. Although, in any other case, I think the women's organizations would be saying, what about the fact she was transferred against her will to the Pentagon? That's what happens in power when they're, unfortunately today, most people in power are the men. Most sexual relationships with somebody that's powerless, the powerless person is a woman. And she loses control of her career at that point. She, you know, what if Monica Lewinsky had wanted to break off the relationship? How can she do that and keep her job? What if she doesn't want to get transferred? She lost control of her career. But more importantly, when this goes on and is cultivated in the workplace, if it was, then what you send is a signal to every other man that this is okay, and you send the message to every woman that people may get the paid job and not be sent home at the end of the intern period.
You're absolutely right about it. I agree very much with everything you're saying. I think we're talking about two different things. I do want to point out that what you said about the message it sends to other men is absolutely correct, because there's very, very strong research data that shows that when high-level management engage in this kind of behavior, that it basically gives permission to everybody else there to also engage in it, and you get much higher levels of sexually inappropriate behavior, and that's been documented scientifically.
Roxanne Conlon, attorney from Des Moines, Iowa, who just won this $80 million sexual harassment case yesterday. Can you speak up, please?
Yes. One of the important things in discussing the law is to know that favoritism based on a consensual sexual relationship is not sexual harassment. The way that the law has developed indicates that while that may be unethical and unwise, it is, according to the recent case law, not illegal. It's also important to remember that conduct which is welcome is not sexual harassment, and in order to be sexual harassment, conduct must be either very severe, as in the case of my client who was sexually assaulted, or so pervasive that it changes a term or condition of the working environment. And so we're not talking here about conduct that is in the gray area, either with my client or with most other people who bring lawsuits. We're talking about conduct that everyone who looked at it would agree was really outside the pale.
Well, I think, this is Ian Northup again, I think that you make a lot of very strong points here, and I certainly understand, having been on the other side of the political spectrum, what it feels like to see somebody that you want to be successful, as the women's organizations feel about this president, and to have to also try to be an independent sort of critic about a standard. But I would say there's great discrepancy between the demand for public hearings and sort of finding every sort of way to define and criticize somebody who is on the other side of the political spectrum. And I think that what people and many, many women in the workplace understand those sort of unwritten rules, those things that make them feel undermined every single day. And women's organizations have been wonderful for what they have done to raise their awareness standard across this country. And because of their personal political commitment to this president, in my opinion, they have chosen to find all the reasons to defend this kind of behavior when they wouldn't had it been somebody on the other side of the political
spectrum. Congresswoman, one of the things we don't know is whether or not there was any such behavior, and I think women's organizations,
Attorney Roxanne,
generally, women generally are waiting to determine whether or not such behavior occurred, and certainly at this moment, no one except the two people involved have that information, and both of them have said it has not occurred.
Well, I think that this is Ian Northup again. I think, quite honestly, that, for example, in the Thomas hearings, the women's organizations were very aggressive in demanding that those questions be asked and answered, questions that were not specifically, is it illegal, but asking for a full accounting and saying those men just don't get it. Men that stood on the legal standard saying they don't get it. And
but you've got to remember that Anita Hill, and I was the...
Professor Fitzgerald.
I was the psychological consultant to Professor Hill's legal team, and I was there when all of this went on. And the thing that is fundamentally different about these two cases is not that one was a Republican and one is a Democrat, but that Professor Hill said she didn't like this, that he was offending her, that he was telling her about pornography, that he was talking about pubic hairs on his Coke can, and that he wouldn't stop when she told him to.
And she was also calling him after she was hired in Oklahoma, coming to visit him, following him to three separate workplaces, all because she believed her career depended on continuing that sort of cultivation. And those were the kinds of questions that were asked. Now, you know, I have to tell you that I didn't start this discussion. I was asked my opinion about it. I have not been somebody that believed confrontation is always the way to resolve things. But into my office from around this country have come emails, and we have been overwhelmed by women who say, yes, this is my workplace, and it either there is somebody there that has fostered this feeling, or it has created an undermining of my position in this workplace. And I mean, I've never sort of seen such a basic reaction, except that it touches where an unfairness that many women feel every day, and women's organizations, to their credit, have in the past been the ones that have sort of shared those sort of universal challenges that women face. And they've walked away from them this time.
Well, I don't agree. I don't think that anybody's walked away from anything.
Roxanne Conlon of Des Moines.
There isn't anything to walk away from, and I think that permitting ourselves to be distracted by a set of allegations at this point does a disservice to women generally. You are correct, Congresswoman. A lot of women suffer discrimination and harassment and retaliation in their workplace, and we as a society have decided that that is legally wrong and that remedy should be provided. And that, I think, ought to be the focus of our efforts, and I think that as long as we continue to guess about the nature of a relationship that may or may not even have existed, that we aren't doing what the women of America need to have done, which is to have their rights redressed and to have themselves protected within the workplace.
You know, there was a piece in the New Yorker magazine this past week by Jeffrey Toobin called The Trouble with Sex, Why the Law of Sexual Harassment Has Never Worked. And I know a number of people have taken issue with this. Professor Fitzgerald, do you think the law has worked?
I think the law is working far better than we ever had any right to expect it to. And in fact, I think that a lot of the backlash that we're seeing is exactly because the law is working. You know, Slater once said, backlash is what happens when people realize that change means change. And I think that's exactly what's happening. And now we're hearing people say, oh, it's going too far. Look at all of this. Look at this. For example, look at that poor innocent man at Yale who had his career ruined, which was one of the things that, you know, Toobin was talking about a great deal in the article.
A case of a professor who had a consensual affair with a student, but now has lost his possibility of getting jobs elsewhere because the case became known.
Well,
we only have a few seconds, so we can't
go
into
that. That's not exactly. Well, okay.
I guess what I would say is there's not even a call for an investigation. I don't believe that we in this country would say if everybody in that workplace decided that they were not going to risk coming forward. You know, we haven't talked to the other interns that didn't get jobs. We haven't asked the question, what was so special about Monica Lewinsky that she did and left people like my daughter and your daughter without those possibilities? And I think those are questions we usually ask, and that's my concern.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion, but we can't do it today. So I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, no matter what happens, what comes of the sex scandal in Washington, I think it's very important to address this issue of sexual harassment because people start to learn from the sex scandal what these words mean. And I'm afraid that they are not getting a very accurate picture about what sexual harassment is all about. I want to thank Republican Congressmember Ann Northup from Louisville, Kentucky, also Professor Louise Fitzgerald, who is a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and Roxanne Conlon, attorney who just won this $80 million judgment against UPS in Des Moines, Iowa. And I think it is a funny story Roxanne told me yesterday about how the Des Moines Register hasn't covered that $80 million case, at least until yesterday when that victory happened, because the lawyer for UPS is the lawyer for the Des Moines Register. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a look at what's been going on with Kenneth Starr and President Clinton. We're going to talk to Joe Connison, who writes for the New York Observer, about some money connections between one Richard Scaife, between the American Spectator and the Arkansas case that has been going on for a while. I also want to let people know that there will be a major sexual harassment conference at Yale University that Louise Fitzgerald and others will be at as they look at sexual harassment 20 years after it has been developing. And that's going to take place February 27th, 28th. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and in case you didn't see the movie Wag the Dog, that music was called American Hero from the film Wag the Dog. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Last night, I got a chance to talk to Joe Connison, who is the political editor of the New York Observer, and had an interesting piece in last week's issue called Richard Scaife Paid for Dirt on Clinton in Arkansas Project. Bill's billionaire foe funneled loads of money to American Spectator. Can you say right-wing conspiracy? Well, let's figure out what this is all about. I talked to him just before he went on C-SPAN this morning, and I asked Joe Connison, first of all, who is this billionaire foe, Richard Scaife, and what is the Arkansas Project?
What I learned, Amy, was that money, large sums of money, up to $600,000 a year, had been funneled from foundations controlled by Richard Mellon Scaife, a very right-wing and Clinton-phobic billionaire from Pittsburgh, to the American Spectator Foundation, which is the foundation that publishes the very right-wing and Clinton-phobic American Spectator magazine. But these large sums of money appear to have gone for a secret operation called the Arkansas Project. They were controlled by a lawyer, a rather obscure lawyer in Virginia named Stephen Boynton, and it's not clear even to people at the Spectator what happened with all this money. The publisher of the Spectator, who had worked there for 30 years, resigned over this issue last October, saying that he wanted a fraud audit. And now the Spectator, the people who control the Spectator Board of Directors, say they themselves are investigating whether anything untoward happened with this money. The most interesting relationship that I found was between Vice President of the Spectator Foundation, the lawyer that they hired, Mr. Boynton, and David Hale, the main witness that Ken Starr has been promoting against the president in the Whitewater affair. It turned out out that Mr. Hale was an old, old friend of Mr. Henderson, who was also friendly with Mr. Scaife. There's a very small circle of these people, and that Mr. Boynton, who controlled all of these millions of dollars, admitted to me that he had met with Mr. Hale on several occasions since Mr. Hale began making these accusations against President Clinton. But he couldn't explain to me why he was meeting with Mr. Hale other than to say that they were social meetings or friendly meetings, or that they had gone fishing or something like that, which I didn't find particularly satisfying, but that was all he would say.
Independent prosecutor Kenneth Starr just let Hale out of prison. Can you explain who David Hale is?
David Hale is a swindler from Arkansas, former municipal judge appointed by the Republican governor who preceded Clinton, who, when he was caught stealing from a government loan program of the Small Business Administration, he had stolen well over $2 million, told Republican prosecutors that he had a story to tell them about Bill Clinton, claiming that Mr. Clinton had pressured him to make an illegal $300,000 loan to Mr. Clinton's Whitewater partners, Jim and Susan McDougal, specifically to a company controlled by Mrs. McDougal, the then Mrs. McDougal. And he has told this story to the Whitewater special prosecutor, Ken Starr, and Ken Starr has behaved as if he believed it, to the point that when Hale was recently released after serving his short jail term, Starr actually recommended that he not be forced to give back the $2.2 million that he stole from the American people, which was startling, I think, to many observers. So he is the most important witness for Ken Starr outside of the Monica Lewinsky affair, but back in what he originally was appointed to investigate, Whitewater. The only one who's really accused the president of any wrongdoing. And Starr has gone to great lengths to try to find testimony that could corroborate Hale, who, after all, is an admitted liar and a convicted felon and just not a very good witness.
Who is Theodore Olson?
Theodore Olson is a very close friend of Mr. Starr. They served together in the Reagan administration, and he is now the lawyer, a lawyer for, and on the board of the American Spectator, and he has also been Mr. Hale's lawyer when Mr. Hale was about to be summoned to appear before the Senate Whitewater Committee, which was an appearance that was canceled through Mr. Olson's intervention with the Republicans on the committee. I think they were actually kind of worried that Hale was going to be torn apart by the Democratic counsel in public testimony, and so they got him out of that. But that's who Theodore Olson is. He's a very important Republican operative who told me that he is investigating whether something went wrong with the Arkansas Project and the millions funneled for it by Scaife, and we'll see whether he ever finds anything wrong with that.
A British newspaper is reporting that an Arkansas state trooper named L.B. Brown says he brought more than 100 women to Clinton when he was governor of Arkansas in the 1980s. Who is L.B. Brown?
Well, L.D. Brown is not somebody you'd want to bet your life on anything he said. He is another guy who was paid by the Spectator. I reported in the same story through the same means. He's been on the Spectator payroll on and off, I guess, the last couple of years, although it was hard to find out exactly when. And he's made all kinds of accusations against Clinton, including that Clinton was involved in, you know, cocaine smuggling through MENA Airport and a lot of craziness that's been discredited. He is not a credible figure in any sense.
Joe Connison, the political editor of the New York Observer, just laying out a bit of the internecine connections between Richard Scaife as well as the American Spectator and something known as the Arkansas Project. Well, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we're going to move on now to another issue. Yesterday, in a front-page, top-of-the-fold article, the Washington Post reported that U.N. inspectors in Iraq had found evidence of a 1995 agreement by the Russian government to supply Iraq equipment that could be used to develop biological weapons. In Moscow, the Russian foreign minister vigorously denied the report, but the story cast a negative light on Russia, just as the Clinton administration is opposing Russian efforts to resolve the conflict with Iraq by diplomatic means. In fact, last night I saw on television Secretary of Defense William Cohen saying that very thing. Here you have this country that sold biological weapons to Iraq, and they're trying to come up with a solution. How can you trust them? Well, Russia may have sold a fermentation tank to Iraq that could be used to brew animal feed or deadly germs, according to the Post report. The report relied entirely on unnamed sources. William Cohen said one of the difficulties in dealing with biological weapons and chemical weapons is some of the same equipment that has what we call a dual-use capability. But the U.S. knows all about dual-use capability. According to an exhaustive investigation by then-House Banking Committee Chair Henry Gonzalez, the Republican Party and George Bush personally played a key role facilitating Saddam Hussein's military buildup, which continued up until weeks before Iraq invaded Kuwait. We're joined now by Dennis Bernstein, co-host of Flashpoints, a public affairs show on Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, who's extensively covered the Persian Gulf War, its aftermath, and this issue of where Saddam Hussein got biological weapons. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dennis.
Thanks, Amy.
Well, where did Saddam Hussein get these weapons?
Well, the United States and Europe, of course. According to three exhaustive investigations by the Senate House Banking Committee and also by the LA-based Seaman Wiesenthal Center, they got it from the U.S. and Western Europe. We're talking about over 200 corporations, 86 in Germany, 18 in the U.S., 18 in Britain, 17 in France, and on and on. Gonzalez, picking it up with Gonzalez on a July 27, 1992 floor speech, he accused the Bush administration. He said the Bush administration deliberately, not inadvertently, helped to arm Iraq by allowing U.S. technology to be shipped to Iraqi military and Iraqi defense factories. He went on to say that there was also a full court cover-up of this. And believe me, ship they did. Let me just give you a random sampling, and we're not talking about a 5,000-gallon liter fermentation vat. Let's just take it, give you a cross-section of U.S. corporations, because I could go on forever if we're talking about the Western Europe. Hewlett-Packard, they supplied personal computers for Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission. They sold it to directly to Iraqi weapons facilities. Honeywell, they sold fuel air explosives. Rockwell, Honeywell, Hewlett-Packard, they sold other high-performance electronics directly to the SAAD 16, the major Iraqi a defense missile plant. International Imaging Systems sold imaging technology and hybrid computers for missile programs. Tektronix, computer graphic terminals for the SIAD Missile Center. Vetco Corporation, they supplied vacuum pumps and bellows for nuclear weapons plants. Swift Levick supplied magnets for nuclear weapons plant. American Live Cultures in Rockville, Maryland, not too far from Washington, D.C., supplied live cultures for bacterial research to the Iraqi Ministry of Defense. Should I go on?
Well, I think that gives us a pretty good idea, Dennis. Of course, the United States government at that time was attempting to get to continue this perverse sense of balance of power between Iran and Iraq in the region. They might say that was before there were international sanctions against Iraq, and that once the international sanctions were established following the Persian Gulf War, that you have a whole different scenario in terms of people who might aid them. What would be your response to that?
Well, they might say that, but according to documents collected by Gonzalez and the Senate Banking Committee, it had nothing to do with that. It was about maintaining hegemony in the region, control in the region. Let me quote from a national security directive signed by George Bush in 1989, and this was signed in order to normalize, and I'm quoting now, to create normal relations between the United States and Iraq, which would serve our long-term interests and support stability in the Gulf and the Middle East. He goes on to say in this directive that the United States is committed to support the individual and collective self-defense of friendly countries in the area. By the way, as the United States government had a full court press on to illegally supply weapons around certain international sanctions, there was also a secret operation in which the United States government was supplying certain technology to Israel, which was then supplying it to Iran. The policy really was a pox on both your houses. Let them kill each other as long as we keep our guy put in by the CIA, Saddam Hussein, in power, and our friend Saddam in a position to protect our interests in the region.
Dennis, following up on what Juan asked about what's legal and what's not, whether it was before the sanctions were put in place or after, isn't it true that Gonzalez wanted to see some top officials indicted?
Well, in fact, after Gonzalez started making these extraordinary speeches on the House floor, it got everybody's attention. He was called basically a traitor, and he was that he was jeopardizing national security. 20 Democratic members of the House, led by Jack Brooks, asked for the appointment of a special counsel, an independent prosecutor, to investigate, and I'm quoting, serious allegations of possible violations of federal criminal statutes. And among those violations, by the way, by high-ranking officials of the executive branch, among the violations was conspiracy to defraud the U.S. or to commit offense against the U.S., making false statements, obstruction of justice, concealment of falsification of records, perjury, mail and wire fraud, financial conflict of interest. What was happening here as while these 20 congressmen were asking for an independent counsel, the administration and the Justice Department and the counselor to the president were busy trying to slap the lid on the beginnings of an investigation into an Italian bank based in Atlanta that was making millions of dollars, billions of dollars of loans to Iraq so that Iraq could buy U.S. technology. There was also 1.2...
The BCCI scandal.
That was the BNL. This was the bank, the BNL bank. This was that was related to the BCCI. The BCCI played into this as well. But the situation was that there was in fact calls to the prosecutor there by various Justice Department officials, just trying to inquire about what was going on. As I was saying, this in the face of $1.2 billion. In licenses, over 700 licenses signed by the Bush and Reagan administrations to allow U.S. corporations to sell this dual-use technology to the Iraqis. One more point on this. It is a fact. You know, in 1946, several officials of I.B. Farben, now I'm not for executions, but several officials of I.B. Farben were hanged for supplying the Zycon B gas that we used in the Nazi death camps. We were selling the technology to Iraq right at the time when we had credible information that there was mass gassing of the Kurds.
Dennis, where do you think this goes from here? I mean, clearly the Russian issue leaked unnamed sources to the Washington Post saying Russia selling some kind of equipment for biological weapons to Iraq is a clear-cut way to undermine Russia now as they try to reach a diplomatic solution with Iraq. You have 20 seconds to answer.
Well, I'm not sure. It sounds to me like an incredible intelligence ploy. That, by the way, that article in the Washington Post had no named sources. It was all intelligence, and it was all unnamed. And I would be surprised if there was substance to it. But I'm not sure what's going to happen here. I'm not sure what could be done. But I hope that people get out there and say something about this.
Well, Dennis Bernstein, thanks for joining us, a Pacifica reporter from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Again, we continue to like to know what you're doing around the possible U.S. strike against Iraq. Let us know. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Our fax number is 212-564-5359. That's 212-564-5359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo and Laura Flanders, Errol Maitland, our engineer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!